If you ache for truth, goodness, and beauty, if you're hungry for a Christianity with substance and strength, if you long for a faith that's big and bold and biblical and all about Jesus Christ, if you're inspired by the idea of one church that has spanned 20 centuries, 24 time zones, and two hemispheres, enfolding every race, nation, and language, then you're considering Catholicism. Considering Catholicism. Deep dives. Whenever we talk about the Bible, we have in mind the complete Old and New Testaments, bound together. Now, the list of those books is called the canon, the biblical canon. For Protestants who insist that the written scriptures alone are the only source of Christian truth, that means 39 books in the Old Testament and 27 in the New Testament, for a total of 66 canonical books. Of course, the Catholic Old Testament preserves 7 books that were removed by the Protestants during the Reformation. And we'll discuss the differences between the Protestant and Catholic Old Testaments in a later installment in this series. As we experience them today, all of these books are organized by chapters and verses and tightly integrated so that the verses in the Old Testament illumine verses in the New Testament and vice versa. For Protestants, the Church's preaching, teaching, worship, moral theology, and mission all depend on the totality of this tightly integrated canon. For Protestants, to depart from what is written there is to wander into speculation, myth, and heresy. If I had a time machine, I'd go back and ask my former Protestant self, what did the Church do before it had the Bible? Before the canonical list of the Old Testament was even finalized? Before the Gospels and letters of the New Testament were even written? Before these 27 of the documents that were floating around the early church were recognized as inspired by the Holy Spirit and listed as canonical? Before there were chapters, verses, and the integration that allowed the New and Old Testaments to be used to interpret each other? Before it had the Bible, what did the Church's preaching, teaching, worship, moral theology, and mission consist of? How did Christians know what was true? What they should do or say or sing in worship services? How did they know what was right and wrong? Because there was a time when the Church lived without the Bible. For decades, 30, 40, 60 years or more, it lived without the Bible as we think of it. In fact, it not only lived, it thrived. It grew in numbers. It developed structures and systems and liturgies and devotional practices. It transformed lives and communities with a radical new moral code. It pushed to the ends of the earth, making new disciples, baptizing them, and establishing new churches. It's tempting to think of the early church in a sort of compressed timeline, like Jesus dies, rises, there's Pentecost, and then all of a sudden the apostles, especially St. Paul, are traveling around preaching and writing gospels and letters. But it didn't happen all of a sudden. To illustrate, let's take a look at a realistic timeline based on historical events and conservative biblical scholarship. The most conservative estimate for Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection is the year 33, AD 33. There's a lot of reasons for that, and I don't want to take the time to get into them now. But let's stick with that, 33. Now, after the resurrection, Jesus appeared to his disciples and others over a period of 40 days before ascending into heaven. And sometime during those 40 days, up in Galilee, Jesus gave the apostles the Great Commission, which is recorded in Matthew 28. Jesus came to them and said, quote, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything that I have commanded you. And surely I am with you always, to the very end of the age." Unquote. Notice what Jesus does and doesn't command them to do. He commands them to go into all nations and make disciples, baptizing those disciples and teaching them to obey everything that he has commanded the apostles. But notice that he doesn't tell them to go write a Bible. Nowhere in the Great Commission does Jesus say, "Go into all nations, making disciples, and then write a book, and then publish that book, and distribute that book, so that everybody can read the book and come to know me." That's not what he says. He says, "Make disciples, baptize, and teach them everything that I have commanded you," meaning the apostles. Now remember that, because we're going to come back to it later. So 50 days after he ascends, it's still the year AD 33, comes Pentecost. The disciples are filled with the Holy Spirit. The first mass converts are made to the church. And really, it becomes the establishment of the church filled with the Holy Spirit. In fact, this episode is being released on the Friday before Pentecost Sunday. The next really big event that would shape the future of the church and the New Testament was the conversion of Saul, who became known as Saint Paul. That occurred roughly 2 to 3 years after Pentecost, somewhere around 35 or 36 AD. After his conversion on the Damascus Road, according to his own writings in Galatians chapter 1, Paul spent 3 years in Arabia, studying, reflecting, and praying to better understand the Christian faith and be prepared to spread it. He doesn't go back to Jerusalem to meet Peter and the other apostles until somewhere around 38 or 39, 5 or 6 years after the resurrection. He then goes back to his hometown in Asia Minor, Tarsus, and he spends about 5 or 6 years there until about the year 45, when Barnabas brings Paul to Antioch to assist him in teaching the growing Christian community there. That's recorded in Acts chapter 11. Paul and Barnabas spend a year in Antioch before the onset of the famine visit to Jerusalem. Around 46 or 47, Paul and Barnabas carry famine relief funds to help the Christians in Jerusalem. After that, Paul leaves on his first missionary journey, recorded again in the book of Acts. And that lasts between around 47 and 49 AD. In 49, he returns to Jerusalem and reports to the apostles at the Council of Jerusalem, recorded in Acts chapter 15. If you're keeping track, we're now 16 years after the resurrection. And it's around this time that probably the earliest of the New Testament books is written, which is the Epistle of James, right around 49 or 50, around the time of that council in Jerusalem. After that, Paul leaves on his second missionary journey, which runs between about 49 and 52, followed by his third missionary journey, which occurs somewhere between 53 and 57. About 57 AD, Paul returns to Jerusalem, where he's arrested in the temple, and he remains imprisoned in Caesarea Philippi for 2 years before appealing to Caesar and being sent to Rome around 59. He's then imprisoned in Rome, awaiting trial, between 60 and 62. He was released and was free for about 3 years before being rearrested in Rome and martyred with Peter in AD 65 during Nero's persecution of the Christians. All the letters that Paul wrote were during the latter part of those travels and years, up to and including his second imprisonment when he was awaiting martyrdom, in which he probably wrote 2 Timothy in the Mamertine prison, right off the Roman Forum. What about the Gospels? Well, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, along with Acts, were probably written in the late 50s to early to mid-60s. The Gospel of John and Revelation are the last books written sometime around the early 90s. So, the point is that between the Great Commission, when Jesus told the apostles to go into all nations and make disciples, baptizing them and teaching them to obey all that he had commanded, and the writing of the New Testament books, there was about 60 years. And just because these Gospels and letters were written, copied, and widely distributed, didn't mean that every local church had copies of all of them. Not to mention that there were other early Christian writings, and the process of sorting out which were the 27 that would become the official canon of the New Testament continued well into the second century. So, back to the original question. Before the Bible was completed, what did the church's preaching, teaching, worship, moral theology, and mission consist of? How did Christians know what was true, what they should do or say or sing in worship services? How did they know what was right and wrong? Because if we are to believe, as Protestants do, that the Bible is the only source and summit of Christian truth, the only structure and system by which it can live, how did it do all of these things before the Bible was even completed and canonized? Well, the short answer is that it relied on the leadership and teaching of the apostles and the structures, systems, and traditions that they established. That's what the early church writers and theologians say, what the Catholic and Orthodox churches say. Protestants, however, struggle with the question. If I went back in a time machine and asked my former Protestant self that question, I would have confidently said, well, there was this period called the Apostolic Age, when the church was directed by the Holy Spirit through the apostles. But once the apostles wrote the New Testament and died, the Apostolic Age ended, and the age of the Bible began. From that moment on, when the Holy Spirit published the New Testament, God's plan of salvation decreed that the only source of information about Christian doctrine and practice is the Bible. And if my new Catholic self was looking out the door of the time machine, facing my old Protestant self, I'd ask, where is that in the Bible? Where in the Bible is the doctrine of sola scriptura, the Bible alone? Much less all that jazz about the age of the apostles ending and the age of the Bible beginning. I'd ask myself, if doctrines can only come from the Bible, well, where does that doctrine come from? And if it isn't in the Bible, how can it be a Protestant doctrine? Now, we'll explore all of this more deeply later in this series when we do a whole episode about problems with the Protestant doctrine of sola scriptura. But for today, I want to stick with this question. How did the church function for all of those decades before it even had anything that we would recognize today as the Bible? Well, what the New Testament says in multiple places, and what the early Christian writers and theologians record, is that the primary mission of the apostles was to establish the church, not to write and publish the New Testament. Writing the New Testament, which, to be clear, they did infallibly under the influence of the Holy Spirit, was a byproduct of their mission to make disciples, baptize them, and teach them to obey everything Jesus commanded. But it was their preaching, teaching, and actions that were the principal means by which they accomplished their mission. And those actions included passing on what Jesus commanded and entrusting it to a new generation of leaders. For example, in 2 Timothy, Paul instructs his protege Timothy to follow the pattern of the sound words that you have learned from me in the faith and love that are in Jesus Christ. By the Holy Spirit who dwells within us, guard the good deposit entrusted to you. And he goes on to say, what you have heard from me in the presence of many witnesses, entrust to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. In Acts 14, Luke tells us that when Paul and Barnabas had appointed elders in the new churches that they had established, with prayer and fasting, they committed those elders to the Lord in whom they had believed. Now the term elder, which in Greek is presbyter, is where we get the office of priest. And in other passages, we read about the establishment of the office of the overseer, which is in Greek episkopos, from which we get the English words episcopal and bishop. So, the apostles preached, making new disciples. They instructed these new disciples in the things that Jesus had commanded them. and they established church structures and systems through trusted overseers and elders, bishops and priests and deacons, to pass on the oral teachings and traditions that they gave them. And when the New Testament Gospels and letters had been written and began to circulate, nothing in those Gospels and letters contradicted the teachings and traditions of the apostles, because both their teachings and their writings were inspired by the Holy Spirit. But now we get to the really interesting part. When the New Testament Gospels and letters began to be copied and circulated and eventually canonized, what happened to the teachings and traditions? Are we supposed to believe, as Protestants do, that the things the early church knew and did became, at that moment, invalid? As soon as there was a written New Testament, it canceled and shut down the teachings and traditions that were in place. And if that's what you think, then show me the passage in the New Testament that says, once a New Testament book has been assembled, forget everything that you learned and did. Toss all that out and rely only on the written book. Show me that passage. It's okay, I'm waiting. Oh, you can't, because it isn't there. The truth is that the teachings, traditions, and writings of the apostles were all inspired by the Holy Spirit, and together they comprise something that the church calls the deposit of faith. It integrates the legacy and writings of the apostles into the living knowledge and universal practices of the church. To understand this deposit of faith, we must understand the relationship between the sacred scriptures and sacred tradition. And that will be the topic of our next installment in this deep dive into Catholicism and the Bible.